Is it only the birds who are singing here? Or is it also the air conditioning units? Have those mundane and functional sounds of everyday city life become something more? Something musical? You're listening to a clip taken from a sound installation designed for and realised in a small laneway in Melbourne, Australia, by the sound artist and urban design researcher Jordan Lacey. In Lacey's words, it represents a sonic rupture. And Sonic Rupture, a practice-led approach to urban soundscape design, is the title of Lacey's new book, published by Bloomsbury in 2016.
This is New Books in Sound Studies, a collaboration between the New Books Network and the Center for Media, Data and Society at Central European University in Budapest, Hungary. And we are your hosts,
Ian Cook
and Dumi Holdish. And we're really happy to be joined by Jordan to talk about his new book. Jordan is a postdoctoral research fellow at the School of Architecture and Design at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia.
Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Jordan to New Books in Sound Studies. Let's dive straight in. Could you tell us what is a sonic rupture and why do we want to have them in our cities?
Thanks, Ian. The sonic rupture concept really builds off a comment made by Felix Guattari in The Three Ecologies, where he talks about the A signifying rupture. So the concept is derived from my thinking of the sounds of the city as a system of signifiers, and those signifiers determine certain everyday behaviors in the sense that sounds can be considered to be fixed in the city in terms of the quality of sound and the repetition of that sound on a daily basis. So if we think about the sounds of the city as being fixed and therefore expressing a certain type of functional control of everyday behavior, the idea of the rupture is to create a small space or zone or area that is asignifying. That is, the sounds that exist in that space signify nothing. So the idea of the rupture is to remove or take away or disperse controlling signifiers to create a space for experiential diversity or new encounter or creative expression or undefined perceptual engagement, if you like. So it's really focused on the perception of the listener in the city as something that differs from typical everyday perception and experience.
Mm-hmm. And why do we want them? Why would we want a sonic rupture in our city?
Well, I guess there's no reason to assume that everyone would want a sonic rupture in a city. It definitely has a certain political intention. If you take this sort of axiomatic idea that I'm putting forward, which is to say that there might be some sort of relationship between the reduction of possible listening experiences that seem to go hand in hand with the contemporary global city, that is, sounds are reduced to the sounds of air conditioners or the sounds of transport or the sounds of emergency signals, et cetera, et cetera. What sort of effects or impacts does that have on the human being who is constantly immersed within those type of sounds? So if you take the premise, like I do, that reduces human experience to something quite narrow or something that's quite diminished compared to what we could possibly experience, then the rupture becomes desirable as it seeks to create environments that can expand the range of possible experiences, which therefore expands our own sense of self or the possible relationships we can have with the world around us. Of course, if your view is that reducing human experiences and having a functionalized populace is desirable, then you probably wouldn't want a rupture.
Hmm. Well, that's super interesting, Jordan. Can you tell us a bit about what led you to write this book and what is your background? Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am relatively new to sound studies. I came across it in 2010 when I was doing a music course here at RMIT University, and I came across soundscape studies. It was an elective taught in the sound studios where I'm presently based, taught by Lawrence Harvey, who became my PhD supervisor. And it was quite a moment for me coming across soundscape studies, or really acoustic ecology, which was the approach preferred by the studios. Because it brought together three passions in my life, which is music, environmentalism, and education. I've been a musician, self-taught musician, since I was a teenager. I studied environmental sciences in the early 90s and worked as a secondary school teacher for about 15 years before I went back into the university system. And it was pretty amazing to come across something that seemed to hold these three disciplinary approaches, if you like. So that's how I discovered it and immediately thought, this is what I want to do. So I took my work as a musician into the public art realm as part of my PhD, where I studied executed a variety of different public artworks, and was really started to quickly think about that in relationship to the people who are experiencing those works. And it's that research that culminated in the book and the sonic rupture concept.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. As I was just telling you before we started recording, I really enjoyed the book. I mean, it's a book that has four chapters and a couple of shorter musings as well. And then in the beginning of the book, you lay out really this sort of very strong theoretical and analytical apparatus that drives the sonic rupture model. But I think one of the really unique and interesting things about your book is that you talk in detail about the process of how you conceive and realize sound installations, especially in chapter three. And this shows how your practice really informed your theoretical and analytical concerns. And you talk through the process in a number of stages that lead to your model. And these stages relate to five approaches to urban soundscape design that you call subtraction, addition, transformation, passion, and disclosure. So I think a really great way to explore your model would maybe be to talk through these different approaches one by one. And we can play samples from the website which accompanies your book. We'll put a link to this website in the blog that accompanies this post. And then we can talk about each one. Okay, so let's start with the first sound, which is subtraction. And this is the first sample, which is audio sample four, and it's called Shutdown. Okay, so what do we hear here?
So that was a project I completed with a soundscape studies class. I was actually teaching in 2012. I'm actually just writing a paper about that now for the Journal of Sonic Studies. Just submitted the final draft today. So it's rich in my mind. There's an exhaust stack in the middle of a very public area here on RMIT University. And it emits a loud exhaust sound, as you can hear, that is also amplified by a metal awning above the exhaust outlet. And you could think of it as an appalling example of acoustic design, or really at a lack of awareness of how important the impact of sound is on our everyday experiences. So I organize with my students to shut down the exhaust fan outlet, and that's what you can hear about halfway through that sample. What you can also hear in that sample, how is immediately human voice springs forward. And it was a really great example of acoustic ecology's lo-fi, hi-fi concept, which gets criticized in the sound studies world, including my book. But that's actually a great illustration of something Barry Truax talks about when he talks about the alienation that can be caused by lo-fi soundscapes. And he uses this idea of a visual metaphor, that those sort of loud noises are a bit like fog. When you're in fog, you can't see very well, but when the fog lifts, you can see very well. Very similar in this situation. When the exhaust outlet's roaring away, you can't hear any of the voices or the other sounds. They're all masked. But when it goes, suddenly it's activated as social space. People are able to talk clearly. You suddenly see people standing further apart because they don't have to get right up close to each other. So it was a great example of how immediately changing the soundscape of a space can change social behavior. And I think, in fact, it's a great example of the truth in what acoustic ecologists were saying about the lo-fi, hi-fi distinction. But it also marks the departure point for me, where I had to start looking for new approaches.
Mm-hmm. And now this brings us on to the next sample, audio sample 10, which is the air conditioning continued. So as the element's name addition might give away, you're adding something. So you could tell us what did you do here, and what did you add? Where did you add it?
The first thing to say, listening back to that, is I always marvel how unbothered the bird seems by my intervention. sings away as normal. What I realized after subtraction that as important as that approach is, it's extremely difficult to remove noise. I went through quite an intensive 3-month process to organise with the relevant authorities to switch that off for 30 seconds, and it's never been off since. And exploring Melbourne so deeply, it just occurred to me that there is noise wherever I go. You can't escape it. So that's when I start thinking, well, there's a limitation here in the acoustic ecology approach for me as an urban soundscape designer, because I don't have a language with which I can actually interrelate with these noises beyond saying, these noises are awful, they're having a bad impact, I want them to go away. That simply couldn't happen. I had to find a way to interrelate with these noises. So my first attempt was that work, which is where I installed four air conditioners in a laneway that had concealed speakers that were, lo and behold, playing air conditioning noises. Those air conditioning noises were collected on site and transformed in the studio and played back in the site. So it was a matter of adding those sounds to try and create a new impression or a new experience of encountering air conditioning noises. It pointed towards transformation, which I think was more successful in my next work that we'll talk about. But in that case, it marks the departure point from me, where I had to start learning ways to develop an affirmative, positive, creative relationship with my city that necessitates me engaging with the immediate site-specific environment rather than negatively admonishing it and wishing it wasn't there and wanting to run away to nature.
That's wonderful. I should also add at this point, what's really nice about this chapter is that you talk through in such precise detail. I mean, right down to the software that you use to, and with photographs of and screenshots and everything as you go along. So even for those of us who might not have the same sort of technical training or expertise that you have, you can actually really follow the process. But let's move on to the next step, which is transformation. And let's listen to audio sample 29, which is from a different project, and it's called Train Takeoff. So what can we hear here?
So the Liquid Architecture Sound Art Festival, which is a wonderful festival we have here in Australia, invited me to do a work in a very unusual location. It's a cavernous concrete cuboid beneath at one of our central stations, Flinders Street Station. And either side of this cavernous concrete cuboid, platforms with suburban trains arriving and departing. And the concrete walls are very thin, so you can hear, when you're inside this space, you can hear all of these sounds pouring in. The train sounds, the announcement sounds, people talking on the platforms, everything you can imagine. So when the curators of the festival went down to this space, originally I believe they were looking at it as a site for Francisco Lopez to do a performance. And I thought, how on earth will he do a performance in here? It's just so noisy. So they found a more suitable location for Francisco Lopez. And then Philip Samartsis, who was curating the work, contacted me on the basis of my air conditioning works. And this is interesting because Philip Samartsis is an associate professor in sound art, and I guess he would champion a more noise-based approach. Perhaps I should be careful, he may hear that and not agree, but that's how I perceived it at the time, which is different, I guess, to the acoustic ecology approach that I had learnt more so here in the studios. So I was quite lucky that I was able to be exposed to a range of philosophical approaches in sound studies. That's a bit of an aside. So when I went into this space, I set about recording all of the sounds I was hearing in the cabin, and then I did a series of 15-minute performances where audiences would come down into this quite surreal space, and I would purposely trigger sounds in relationship to what I was hearing on the other side of the concrete walls as the trains came in and out. And as I went through day after day, because I spent about a month in this strange environment, it became very difficult to tell what were the noises and what were the sound designs. I think a train station is a great example of what I would refer to as a functionalist imperative in the book, that is the imperative to be functional. Train stations are highly functional, as we want them to be, if we want the trains to run on time. But they're also highly repetitive environments. They're not places that you would expect to have diverse experience. So it was a great way to explore new imaginative ways of engaging with those everyday experiences through blending the design sounds with the real sounds and I think in the book I talk about it as a type of a dreaming, because it did feel like falling into a dreamlike state. And there were lots of wonderful moments, like when I'd blast my train horns and the train driver would blast their train horn in response. And so there was all those kind of interruptions to everyday activities as well. This was not so much a public art installation as a live performance using surrounding urban sounds. But it did point the way to me, for me, which I think is the most important aspect of a public art installation, is that it's able to respond to site-specific conditions by transforming those existing sounds to turn them into something else. And I think that's where the asignifying rupture really comes forth, this idea of the sound as signifier losing its signification and becoming something else, which might be an imaginative or creative response for the listener. How could we populate the city with experiences like that? That's when that insight was revealed, and it marks an evolution of the addition approach.
That's wonderful. I mean, yeah, when I was reading your book, and sometimes I was reading part of it on public transport, and then once you start to think about these processes, what we've gone through so far, you know, subtraction, addition, and then transformation, then you start to think about, what would I do with this sound? What would I do with this sound when you're just moving around the city? So it's a really great way of changing your orientation as well to the city that you're in. Let's move on now to the next element, which is called passion, and this is from a different project, and this is audio sample 32, a triggered sequence from Intimate Footsteps.
Cutish.
This was also a very new listening experience to me, because when I listened to these sounds before, I listened to them at home alone on a computer, and then now I'm facing a dummy and listening to it at the same time. It certainly changed the way that I heard. So this is the stage, the element passion. What were we listening to?
This was an installation for the Design Hub in Melbourne. And it involved an interactive component, which is a chair that you could sit down in, and there were some pressure pads at the end of the chair that were designed by an industrial designer, Frank Feltham, who I work with. And as you squeeze the chair, the chair was placed in the middle of a very long ramp, and then two footsteps would come at you from either direction. And then when they reached you, if you squeezed harder, they started kissing and talking, and the harder you squeezed it, the more passionate they became. And then if you let go, they ran off again. So originally the idea was really to explore this notion of transformation, which had come up in the train work with footsteps, because footsteps are another repetitive everyday sound that we might be used to hearing in the city, although only really high heels, because soft-soled shoes in some ways eliminate our presence as much as noise sources might eliminate our voices. But what I wanted to do in this space, because the footsteps are very present as people move through, I wanted to find a way if the footsteps could create these similar sort of transformative experiences. And you can hear it in that sequence. There is a mixture of Foley footsteps in the installation and real footsteps of people walking past, so which you probably can't tell the difference in the context of listening. But then really when we came to the chair and the idea of these two footsteps coming together, well, what might two people do that come together in the middle of the city that you mightn't often see, or you don't see enough? That's embracing and kissing and talking to each other. And you may see it more in some cities than others. So it was really playing with that idea. And then that's where the notion of the passion approach came. How do you bring passion back into cities that might be alienated or isolating or disconnected? This sort of fanciful notion of two strangers just finding each other and embracing each other in a passionate moment.
I'm just wondering, what's your relationship with these pieces according to to your own listening experience? Because in I think the first two cases, you're surrounded by students and you're doing something with them, and then you have this nice story about interacting with other trains, and here with a larger public in your last piece in the audio sample 32. So I'm just wondering, how do you experience these installations yourself, and does this experience change according to the listening setting?
That's a really interesting question. The first one, I was surrounded by students. The second one was very much alone, although I did work with another sound designer on that, Jeffrey Hannum, who designed the software. And the third one, yes, I was essentially alone in this strange space for a month. And then in the fourth one, surrounded by collaborators and the public. When I listen back, that one still puts a smile on my face, that's for sure.
Passion, you mean?
I mean, the sounds of the kisses are very convincing, because they are, in fact, real kisses. I guess there's a maybe more of a – I'd hesitate to use a coldness, but given that the material of the earlier ones is dealing only with noises, there's a kind of a strangeness to them, I guess, because in a way they're drawing your attention to something we probably typically push to the background. They're not only drawing our attention, they're recreating our experience of them. I mean, I suppose for me personally, the experience of listening back to most of these is so unlike the experience of being in the original installation. And this is actually a big problem for any site-specific installation artist. You can never truly recreate the experience the way that a composer could a piece of work in a concert hall, for instance, or a sculptor could one of their works in a gallery. It only works in that moment, and the sort of documentation that we're listening to is just a diminished representation of the actual experience. So for me, it's like a reminder of a more poignant moment, I guess.
Yeah, I guess listening is a very environmental experience in the end.
Yeah. And it's really interesting.
It is when you're working in public environments. I mean, of course, when you're working with media, it can be an experience you have anywhere, like listening back to this this interview, for instance.
Mm-hmm. I just want to follow up on this site-specific nature of your work. There's a wonderful story in terms of the project that you did with the air conditioning units when some graffiti artists interacted with your sound designers. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks for picking up on that, because that was the most exciting moment for me in the whole research process. We have a wonderful graffiti culture here in Melbourne, very creative and up there with the best in the world. And this particular laneway just happened to be a favoured spot for graffiti artists. And it was quite a coincidence that when the installation started, the day before, the City of Melbourne executed their anti-graffiti policy, which only is focused on certain walls, because the opposite wall where I was protected because there was some historically significant graffiti, but the other wall wasn't significant. So what they would do is come and paint it grey. And it's just coincidence that occurred at that time, but this wall got painted grey 3 or 4 times while the installation was running. And of course, painting a wall grey is just an invitation for a graffiti artist to come and produce a new work. So while the work was playing, there was graffiti forms coming up that were clearly sonic in nature. And being someone who enjoys looking at graffiti, I could see there was something different. And in the book, you can see certain graffiti forms such as 4 overlapping circles, which is a great sonic representation of 4 speakers, which is what the work consisted of. Or there was the somebody's head, but with their ear facing out, listening instead of looking out, like a lot of graffiti does. And there was sort of these gestural sequences on the ground, because something that doesn't come through in those recordings is the fact that those sounds are moving across the 4 speakers. They're spatialized. So there was these graffiti lines coming off the wall and onto the ground and all these interesting shapes. And I just thought, it feels to me like this graffiti is responding to the sound. And lo and behold, this very sharp-looking dude came up to me one day and while I was doing some recordings and said, "Are you the artist?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "Oh, yeah, my mates have been coming down painting to this." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, for sure." So that was my verification. Can't prove that to the world because I didn't record the conversation, but it certainly happened. And what really struck me was how the city is, in fact, a highly creative ecology. And if you produce these ruptures, that open experience, when people enter that rupture point, they're given the opportunity or perhaps the creative compulsion to produce their own creative responses to that effective environment. That's certainly the aim of a rupture. And so it was extremely exciting for me to see these graffiti artists responding to the new sonic environment in such a interrelated way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now thanks a lot. And now let's go to the last stage of your model, Disclosure. And we're going to listen to Hallway, Below Studio, Lots of Dreams Extended.
And I sometimes walk around making sure I fall asleep. But why do you have to sleep all the time at night? I dreamt I went back to an island. It was beautiful. There's lots of dreams around here. It's very lovely. I don't think you do.
Okay, so one of the things that we learn about you in the book is that you declare, in fact, that you do not believe in ghosts. But let's with this last sample that we just listened to in mind, can you tell us what were we listening to here?
So a friend of mine, Kashi Lynch, is a sculptor.
Okay, let's stop that again.
I think it's probably fair to say she does believe in ghosts. And she was commissioned to do a work at the Abbotsford Convent, which was a nunnery here in Melbourne for many, many years. And now it's an artist-run studio. And Kashi had decided to invite two mediums to walk with her through the convent and to communicate with the spirits or the energetics of this building. And Kashi invited me to come along and record the conversations that they had, and then to turn those conversations into short sound segments that people could listen to through headphones as they walked the same path or visited sites of significance as determined by the mediums. They could listen to these sound files. The notion of disclosure came through for me because what I loved about this idea, of course, is that the mediums were claiming to disclose the stories of lingering spirits and presences that otherwise couldn't be perceived. But also while this was happening, I was listening to the beautiful creaks of the old wooden stairs as we walked up and down them, or the squeaks of the old heavy doors as they moved on their hinges and slammed behind us. They just created such a beautiful ambience. And then it occurred to me that by interacting with the environment and paying special attention to it, we were disclosing sounds that would otherwise be hidden from our perception. So I think I describe this particular approach, as I do passion, as a bifurcation in terms of the main arc of research, which revealed subtraction, addition, transformation. But it seemed to me a significant enough approach to include in the model.
Okay, thanks a lot. Just to remind our listeners, the five approaches to urban soundscape design that you propose in your model are subtraction, addition, transformation, passion, and disclosure. And as a way of closing our discussion on your book, could you please tell us how these different approaches interact in your sonic rupture model and what the implications of this model are for urban soundscape design?
I think the most important thing to say here is that the model itself, which looks quite geometric and diamond-shaped in the book, which doesn't necessarily have an intention of in and of itself, except to say that's the limit of my graphic design capabilities. The core of this model is relationships. It's about the artist forming a relationship with a site such that the site were like a living thing. So that relationship is something that's dialogical, you know. It goes backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. So it's about the artist immersing themselves within a site, learning from the site, teaching the site, and then extracting some type of meaning or creative intention that would then augment that site or rupture that site. So the way that the five approaches relate is that they're all connected by this notion of the relationship, the idea of the influence of the environment on the artist, and then the influence of the artist's intentions on the environment, and then how they come together to form this rupture point. How an approach might be taken is completely up to the artist and the relationship they form. It could be one of the five approaches put forward in the model, or it could be something completely different. It is possible that someone could study this model and say, we want to put this particular approach in action in this particular space. For example, that could be an urban soundscape design. approach to its use. So the artistic approach of this model is to say this is about relationships, and through that relationship, the appropriate approach will reveal itself. But as an actual tool for urban soundscape design, it could put in front of the designer or the planner a suite of potential approaches that could be applied in some curated, networked sense across the city to ensure that there is a range of experiences that the urban dweller can encounter. I think that's the best way I can answer that question.
It's a very good way to answer the question. So I don't know, Ian, if you don't have anything to add. Jordan, then finally, now that the book is out, can you tell us a bit about your current and future projects?
Well, I just finished writing two articles for The Conversation. Are you aware of The Conversation?
Nope.
It's a wonderful forum for academics to present their research in a journalistic style to everyday public. And so I'd encourage the listener to go into a search engine, and if you put in The Conversation and Jordan Lacey, an article will come up that's explaining precisely what my present research projects are. But what I'm trying to do is something that I propose in the conclusion of the book, and it's a challenge to sound artists like myself to start thinking about ways that we can engage and interface with industry. And by industry, I mean government, I mean councils, which is government, of course, I mean corporations. How can we engage with them to find ways that we might be able to introduce the sonic rupture in their everyday infrastructure projects? Of course, I don't necessarily call it a rupture when I approach them, because it sounds like something quite violent or like a very unfortunate health outcome. I don't really want to go into the depths of Guattari's A signifying rupture with them, at least as I understand it, which isn't to say they wouldn't be interested, but they are very busy people. So I'm presently working with a motorway infrastructure company looking at the ways that we can transform noises after they've been attenuated by noise walls. And we've been working with ethnographers, including Sarah Pink and Shanti Somatoyo, to bring local community members down to these parklands or into backyards to see if they're more habitable spaces once these noise transformations have been applied to otherwise very uninviting sound environments of motorway noise. That's one project I'm working on. Second project I'm working on is I've been commissioned by a council, which is like a local government authority here in Melbourne, with a group of researchers to try and create a sound mark or a point of meaningful sonic identity. And we've taken a very experimental approach with this that I could talk about for a very, very long time. So I think, how can I summarize this very quickly? But essentially, we worked with the community to identify what for them were the meaningful sounds of their community. We then commissioned sound artists to conduct some field recordings to capture those sounds. And I think we ended up with a total of 142 different field recordings, which can play back at random within this specifically designed location in the plaza of a community center. The location itself contains what's called a sensing stone. This is actually a piece of basalt with aluminium strips carved within it that are interactive. So as you touch these aluminium strips, it'll play back these field recordings in specific ways. And it will also, and this is very much the disclosure approach, there are two metal plates on the ground that you stand on with transducers beneath them, and as you touch the stone, these will vibrate and hum and send specific vibrations through your body as you're hearing these field recordings. So the first project I see very much as the application of the transformation approach, and the second project I see is the application of the the addition and the disclosure approaches. So, so I did feel that if I was going to propose this model in my book, I better demonstrate how it can work as well.
Yeah, and they both sound like absolutely fascinating projects. We look forward to hearing more about those in the future. There's not much more for us to do today apart from to thank you a lot for coming on New Books in Sound Studies. I know we both really, really enjoyed your book. I read it first and then gave it to Dummy. And as I was coming to the office every day, I was like, oh, did you read that bit yet? Did you read that bit yet? So it was like, we've been discussing this book on and off for about 3 weeks. So it's really been really great to have you on. So yeah, thanks again. And thanks a lot for the chance to talk about your wonderful book.
Yeah, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Sound Studies. We've been your hosts, Dumi Holdish
and Ian Cook. And today we've been talking about Sonic Rupture by Jordan Lacey. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation as much as we have, and we hope you'll listen again next time. Ta-ra!